to Moist Media Reading Event as part of Hannah's show and project that we're just having in the library at the moment. And so thanks so much for bringing us together and providing such a great provocative reading in the library present online that we can read and comment on and enjoy. But tonight, Hannah's kind of brought together a range of people who are going to read for us various things, and their own words or the words of others. So we just decided that the order would go in this direction from the people, which would mean that we're starting with Barbara.
You will have to excuse my I'm going to read a text by Ursula Le Guin called She and Lindsay, which is a text about animals, basically. So, she and Lindsay. Most of them accepted namelessness with a perfect indifference with which they had so long accepted any non-animals. Whales and dolphins, seals and sea otters, consented with particular grace and alacrity, sliding into anonymity as into their element. A faction of yaks, however, protested. They said that yaks sounded right, and that almost everyone who knew that they existed called them that. Unlike the ubiquitous creatures such as rats and fleas, who had been called by hundreds of thousands of different names since Babylon, the yaks could truly say, they said, that they had a name. They discussed the matter all summer. The councils of the elderly female finally agreed that though the name might be useful to others, it was so redundant from the yak point of view that they never spoke it themselves and hence might as well dispense with it. After they presented the argument in the set level, their rules, a full consensus was delayed only by the onset of several heavy blizzards. Soon after the beginning of the thaw, their agreement was reached and the designation yak was returned to the donor. Among the domestic animals, few horses had cared what anybody called them since the failure of Dan Swift's attempt to name them from their own vocabulary. Cattle, sheep, swines, asses, mules, and goats, along with chickens, geese, and turkeys, all agreed enthusiastically to give their names back to the people to whom, as they put it, they belonged. A couple of problems did come up with pets. The cats, of course, steadfastly denied ever having had any name other than those self-given, unspoken, ineffably personal names, which, as the poet named Emmy Elliott said, they spend long hours daily contemplating. Though none of the contemplators has ever admitted that what they contemplate is their names, and some onlookers have wondered if the object of that meditative gaze might not in fact be the perfect or platonic mouse. In any case, it is a moot point now. It was with the dogs and with some parrots, lovebirds, ravens, and minnow that the trouble arose. These verbally talented individuals insisted that their names were important to them and flatly refused to part with them. But as soon as they understood that the issue was precisely one of individual choice and that anybody who wanted to become Rover or Fufu or Polly or in the personal sense was perfectly free to do so, not one of them had the least objection to parting with the lowercase, or as regards German creatures, uppercase. Generating affiliation, poodle, parrot, dog, or bird, and all the linear qualifiers that had trailed along behind them for 200 years, like tin cans tied to a tail. The insects parted with their names in vast clouds and swarms of ephemeral syllables, buzzing and stinging and humming and flitting and crawling and tumbling away. As for the fish of the sea, their names dispersed from them in silence throughout the oceans like faint, dark blurs or cuttlefish ink, and drifted off on the currents without a trace. None were left now to a name, and yet how close I felt to them When I saw one of them swim or fly or trot or crawl across my way or over my skin or stop me in the night or go along beside me for a while in the day, they seemed far closer than when their names had stood between myself and them like a clear barrier. So close that my fear of them and their fear of me became one same fear. And the attraction that many of us felt, the desire to smell one another's smell, feel or rub or caress one another's scale of skins or feathers or fur, taste one another's blood or flesh, keep one another warm, that attraction what was now all one with the fear, and the hunter could not be told from the hunted, nor the eater from the food. This was more or less the effect I had been after. It was somewhat more powerful than I had anticipated, but I could not now, in all conscience, make an exception for myself. I resolutely put anxiety away, went to Adam and said, "You and your father lent me this. Give it to me, actually. It's been really useful, but it doesn't exactly seem to fit very well with me. But thanks very much. It's really been very useful." It is hard to give back a gift without sounding peevish or ungrateful, and I did not want to leave him with that impression of me. He was not paying much attention, as it happened, and said only, "Put it down over there, okay?" and went on with what he was doing. One of my reasons for doing what I did was that talk was getting us nowhere, but all the same I felt really let down. I had been prepared to defend my decision, and I thought that perhaps when he didn't notice, he might be upset and want to talk. I put some things away and fiddled around a little, but he continued to do what he was doing and take no notice of anything else. At last I said, "Well, goodbye, dear. I hope the garden key turns up." He was fitting parts together and said, without looking around, "Okay, fine, dear. When's dinner?" "I'm not sure," I said. "I'm going now with the," I hesitated and finally said, "with them, you know," and went on out. In fact, I had only just realized how hard it would have been to explain myself. I could not shatter away as I used to do, taking it all for granted. My words now must be as slow, as new, as single, as tentative as the steps I took going down the path away from the house, between the dark branches, tall dancers motionless against the winter shine.
I said a few things. I don't know if I'm going to read all of them. The first is from Real. Francis Jones and Lorraine Mixer. Lorraine Mixer was Miss Universe in 1983. I found this on the free table outside the McMillan Brown Library at the University of Canterbury, and I thought I had to pick it up. Like, why would you? It's amazing. So I'm just going to read just a couple of. I kind of want to do a picture book show and tell from like primary school public libraries, but I'm not going to pick some choice quotes right out here.
Mostly pictures.
No, just block quotes that have been pulled out from the text. I'm going to see the double screen because it's not great. Personal style only evolves once you clearly identify the way you want to look, whilst being unrelenting about appropriateness, subtlety, and wearability. This is probably my favourite one. No one will think you've turned into an alliance voter, or that you're having an extramarital affair if you turn down your collar and wear trousers for a change. So that's not placing it squarely in a title. Place in New Zealand, and then in the colour and accessories section, which is something I was wearing less black and why. accessories can be an area fraught with danger. The golden rule is: buy quality, wear it sparingly, and remember to compliment, not overwhelm your clothes. An amazing selection of like gauche as well. So I'll leave this out for people to browse, because it's pretty amazing.
What library was that from?
That's from the University of Canterbury Library. And maybe the Miller Brown Library read all the New Zealand material or something. Yeah. So, it's in Great Neck. Not that issued many times, I don't think. I also brought a couple of pieces that I wrote in a previous pseudo-parallel lifetime. One is a media manager at an internet startup. And I saw the hyper-personalized model on the Google Doc. So I'll read a little bit of this. It's not the most fascinating stuff in the world, but the title is The Hyper-Personalized Business Model Trend. March 2008, online product sourcing directory Salehu conducted an e-commerce behavioral survey of its members. Salehu's members are dedicated online sellers and retailers, and they are knowledgeable and savvy e-commerce users. The survey was comprised of 8 questions, 4 demographic questions, and 4 individual response questions, and it was a follow-up to a similar survey conducted 3 years earlier. The answers showed a shift in trend that is consistent with other e-commerce activity across the web. In particular, the answer to the question, what products are you interested in sourcing for your online business, generated a vastly different response than it did 3 years ago. In 2008, which is when this was written, more than 50% of respondents said that their search for sources included locating niche markets. The survey conducted 3 years ago yielded considerably different results. Only 20% of respondents mentioned niche markets. At that time, the majority of sellers wanted access to hot items such as iPods, Xboxes, and designer brand clothing. The second question category that witnessed the greatest movement was, where are you planning to sell your products? In 2005, most respondents were selling on eBay and had eBay storefronts. In 2008, the statistic had changed dramatically, and there's been a visible shift away from eBay, with most now setting up their own stores using Craigslist, eCrater, and other online auction venues to sell their goods. And flip through. A change in direction. What these changes indicate is a move from popular markets and marketplaces to a more evenly spread distribution of sellers across niche markets and throughout what is called the long tail. Wide editor and chief Chris Anderson coined the long tail in 2004. In e-commerce, the term describes selling small amounts of scarce or hard to obtain products to many people. Due to traditionally low overheads and particularly low distribution costs, internet businesses are able to realize the long tail. The shift illustrated in the survey shows a push towards the long tail and market fragmentation. This push has been likely caused by the following factors: market saturation, the move to mainstream, improved education, and innovation. Niche's new focus. Niche markets are a move away from a one-size-fits-all mentality toward a more valuable customer experience. This is reflected in higher rates of online customer satisfaction in 2007. Netflix and Amazon polled the highest for customer satisfaction in an annual report released by 4C Results. Both companies have taken initiatives to make the customer experience more customized and more personalized, something that all retailers will have to do as the trend continues. Personalization is about empowering customers and going further than lip service and the noise around crowdsourcing. Primarily, it's about listening to customers and providing tailored customer service. Even though e-commerce is in a better position to adapt to this, larger corporations can struggle. eBay has proved it is still set in its ways time and time again with its canned responses to customer service queries. Real personalization occurs when the seller's knowledge complements the buyer. Starting a business as a hobby or because of a real passion is the key to succeeding in niche marketing. Plus, a background in a given industry is invaluable when thinking about which problems need to be solved. Customization is best exemplified by make-on-demand site Pinoco, where designers upload blueprints and users then order the items to be made to their size and material specifications. Offline, Borders will be adding electronic kiosks in its stores that will enable customers to try self-publishing. One thing is certain, now that market fragmentation has started, it will only continue, and the e-commerce landscape in 3 years will be significantly different than it is today. Expect specialization to become the norm as e-commerce moves towards hyper-personalized business models. Yeah, and I had one other that I'm just going to go to the end on. I wrote it in 2009 for Stuff, and it was Twitter, social tool, or annoying fad. Thanks, Amelia. I feel that. when I read that. And I'm just going to go to 7 reasons to hate Twitter, which I got a lot of tweets about. I had a Twitter account there, and people were angry that I included 7 reasons to hate Twitter at the end of this article, but my editor made me do it, so I had to put it in. 7 reasons to hate Twitter. This is in 2009, by the way. 1. Constant evangelizing by techies coupled with the suggestion that Twitter can solve world peace. Funnily enough, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg said the same thing on Facebook last year. 2. Users indulging in self-aggrandizement. Arrogance is arrogance. The song remains the same across different media. 3. Quotes from famous people masquerading as meaningful sentences. Blame the 140 characters for this. 4. Not knowing when to use the reply or direct message function. Use the direct message function to ask your husband to pick up milk on his way home. We do not need to know this. Those interesting gendered bodies in that one. 5. Social marketing gurus, follower collectors, and businesses that have decided to use Twitter as another advertising channel. Symmetrical communication? Too hard. Let's just spam people. 6. Banal served with a twist of legend. 7. Fixing twit to everything. And that was a pro of a sentence where I said, a twibe is twingo for a Twitter tribe. And just so you know, it's possible to relate anything to Twitter by adding a twit prefix. I just made twingo up, twijic.
A bit of a change of pace, but I'm going to read from Tikkun, which is it was originally published in the 90s by this anarchist group, Tikkun in France, and then recently translated by Semiotix, I think, in 2011 by Ariana Raines, who's like a French poet, and it's quite a beautiful translation. It's called Preliminary Materials for a Theory of the Young Girl, and it's supposed to be presented as a kind of quite a fragmented theory, so there's kind of interjections from quotes taken from advertising, and things kind of are quite fluid, and change topic a little bit, but I'm just going to read an excerpt. The young girl as phenomenon. The young girl is old insofar as she is known to be young. There is therefore no question for her of benefiting from this reprieve, which is to say of committing the few reasonable excesses of experiencing the few adventures expected of people her age, and all this with an eye to the moment when she will have to settle down into the ultimate void of adulthood. Thus, during the time it takes for youth to decay, social law contains its own violations, which are, in the end, just exemptions. The young girl is obsessed with authenticity because it is a lie. The masculine young girl is paradoxical in that she's the product of a sort of alienation by contagion. Although the feminine young girl appears as the incarnation of a certain alienated masculine imaginary, there is nothing imaginary about the alienation of this incarnation. It is altogether concretely that she has eluded those whose fantasies she populates in order to face and dominate them. As the young girl emancipates herself, blossoms and multiplies, the dream turns into an all-consuming nightmare. It's at this point that her former slave returns to tyrannize yesterday's master. In the end, we witness an ironic epilogue in which the male sex becomes both the victim and the object of its own alienated desire. I want people to be beautiful. The young girl is the figure of the total and sovereign consumer. She carries herself as such in every domain of existence. The young girl knows so very well the value of things. Often, before her decay has become too obvious, the young girl gets married. The young girl is only good for consuming, pleasure or work, it doesn't matter. The intimacy of the young girl, now equivalent to all intimacy, has become something anonymous and exterior, an object. The young girl never creates anything. All in all, she only recreates herself. By investing young people and women with an absurd symbolic surplus value, by making them the exclusive carriers of the two new kinds of esoteric knowledge proper to the new social order, consumption and seduction, spectacle has effectively emancipated the slaves of the past, but it has emancipated them as slaves. The most extreme banality of the young girl is to take her or himself for an original. The stunted quality of the young girl's language, although it implies an incontestable narrowing of the field of experience, in no way constitutes a practical handicap, because it was not made to talk with, but rather to please and repeat. Chatter, curiosity, equivocation, hearsay, the young girl incarnates the fullness of the improper existence, whose categories Heidegger identified. The young girl is a lie whose apogee is the face. In the young girl, what is most sweetest is also the cruelest, what is most natural is the most feigned, what is most human is most machine-like. Adolescence is a recent category created according to the demands of mass consumption. The young girl invariably calls happiness everything to which they chain her. The young girl is never simply sad, she is also sad that she's sad. Ultimately, the young girl's ideal is domestic. Albertine comes from nowhere and is very modern in that way. She flutters, comes and goes. From her absence of attachment, she derives the instability and the unpredictable quality which give her her power of freedom. That's from For Albertine, Proust in the Sense of the Social by Du Bois. When it addresses itself distinctly to the young girl, the spectacle is not above a bit of bathmology. This is why the entire significance of boy bands and girl bands comes from making a show of the very fact of making a show. The lie consists here by means of crude irony in presenting as a lie what is on the contrary the truth of the young girl. The young girl is struck by sudden vertigo whenever the world stops revolving around her. The young girl sees herself as the holder of a sacred power, the power of commodities. The young girl wants to be desired without love or loved without desire. There is no threat in either case to her unhappiness. The young girl has love stories. Just like the magazines they intend for her and which she devours so painfully, the life of the young girl is divided and organized into so many columns, between which the greatest separation reigns. The young girl is that which, being only this, scrupulously obeys the authoritarian distribution of roles. Love for the young girl is just autism for two. The young girl resembles her own photo. Insofar as her appearance entirely exhausts her essence, as her representation does her reality, the young girl is that which is entirely expressible, perfectly predictable, and absolutely neutralized. The young girl exists only in proportion to the desire they have for her and knows herself only by what they say she is. The young girl appears as a product and the principal outcome of the formidable surplus crisis of capitalist modernity. She is the proof and the support of the limitless pursuit of the process of valorization when the process of accumulation proves limited. The young girl knows everything is devoid of consequences, even her own suffering. Everything is funny, nothing's a big deal, everything is cool, nothing is serious. The young girl wants to be recognised not for what she might be, but for the simple fact of her being. She wants to be recognised in the absolute. The young girl is not here to be criticised. When the young girl arrives at the age limit of, and I mixed up that, the last bit is the young girl doesn't kiss you, she drools over you through her teeth. Materialism of secretions.
I'm going to read from a Nina Power article called The Feminization of Labour. So, here we go. When people talk about the feminization of labour, then their discourse is often double-edged. The phrase is at once descriptive. Work is generally more precarious and communication-based, as women's jobs tended to be in the past, and an expression of resentment. Women have stolen proper men's jobs. It's their fault somehow that we don't have any proper industry anymore. There are more women in work, and work itself has become more female. As Christina Moreni puts it, the feminization of labour is used to define not only the objective aspect of the quantitative increase in the active female population around the world, but increasingly underlines the qualitative and constituent character of this phenomenon. Alternatively, we could turn this around and talk about the labourisation of women, the way in which females are cast as worker first and only secondarily as mother or wife, or any other identity position not linked with economic productivity. Obviously, neither the feminization of labor nor the laborization of women are total phenomena, nor complete. The glorious world of work stumbles at various obstacles: pregnancy, age, lack of education, desperation, particularly of migrant and illegal workers, the nannies and cleaners who work so that richer women can do the same. The job market continues to differentiate between men and women. The most blatant is the surprisingly resilient pay differential for the same jobs, and the predominance of women in part-time and badly paid work. Sometimes this is related to an underlying assumption about who bears the brunt of the burden for childcare, but not always. If men's wages too have been depressed, if there literally aren't enough jobs or enough money to pay for them, what with the daily to pay CEOs so many more times than anyone else, not to mention the precious shareholders, then the category woman remains a useful one for the first fired, last hired policy that has characterized the employment market for much of the last 100 years or so. The discourse of work as pure emancipation depends on blocking out class and age constantly. The menopausal unconscious comes back to haunt the perky young professional, and the spectre of the ex-worker at home looking after her kid angers the market, even as it depends on the biological reproduction to sustain its own future. Nevertheless, images of a certain kind of successful woman proliferate: the silly worker in heels, the flexible agency employee, the hard-working hedonist who can afford to spend her income on vibrators and wine. And what have us believe that yes, capitalism is a girl's best friend. The demand to be an adaptable worker, to be constantly networking, selling yourself, in effect to become a kind of walking CV, is felt keenly by both sexes in the developed world. Arguably, however, this omnipresent imperative is interpreted differently by the sexes. David Harvey poses this question in the following way: what effect does the circulation of variable capital, the extraction of labour, power and surplus value, have on the bodies, persons and subjectivities, of those through whom it circulates? If the contemporary world of work on one level doesn't care who does the job as long as it is done, on the other it cannot forget the internal history of the transformations in gender roles when it has costs to shave or profits to reap by doing so. Capitalism selectively remembers that women are women. Moreni argues that transformations in the organisation of work, particularly the rise of precarity, means that labour itself has become essentially feminised. Work is an effective occasion for the emancipation of women in the face of male oppression, albeit within the limits set by the hierarchical organisation of work. Thanks to the level of generalised precariousness, which has been transformed into a structural element of contemporary capitalism, work which becomes a woman is tantamount to saying that the fragmentation of the service provided and the complexity of the dependence slash absorption, which women have experienced at various times in the labour market, ends up becoming a general paradigm irrespective of gender. In this sense, it can be maintained that the figure of social precariousness today, is woman. In cognitive capitalism, precariousness, mobility and fragmentation become constituent elements of work for all persons, irrespective of gender. All work has become women's work, even that of men. No wonder the young professional woman beams down at us from the real estate billboards as the paradigmatic image of achievement. As Vernon puts it, correctly understood, post-borders professionality does not correspond to any precise profession. It consists rather of certain character traits. At this point in economic time, those character traits are remarkably feminine, which is why the pragmatic, enthusiastic professional woman is a symbol for the world of work as a whole.
I'm going to read a poem by Eileen Miles. It's from this anthology called Hatred of Capitalism. It's called An American Poem. I was born in Boston in 1949. I never wanted this fact to be known. In fact, I've spent the better half of my life trying to sweep my early years under the carpet and have a life that was clearly just mine and independent of the historic fate of my family. Can you imagine what it was like to be one of them, to be built like them, to talk like them, to have benefits of being born into such a wealthy and powerful American family? I went to the best schools, had all kinds of tutors and trainers, traveled widely, met the famous and the controversial and the not so admirable, and I knew from a very early age that if there were any ever possibility of escaping the collective fate of this famous Boston family, I would take the route, and I have. I hopped on an Amtrak to New York in the early 70s, and I guess you could say my hidden years began. I thought, well, I'll be a poet. What more could be foolish and obscure? I became a lesbian. Every woman in my family looks like a duck, but it's really stepped off the flag when you become one. While holding this pose, I have seen and I have learned, and I am beginning to think there is no escaping history. A woman I am currently having an affair with said, you know, you look like a Kennedy. I felt the blood rising in my cheeks. People have always laughed at my Boston accent, confusing large for lodge, party for potty. But when this unsuspecting woman invoked for the first time my family name, I knew the jig was up. Yes, I am. I am a Kennedy. My attempts to remain obscure had not served me well. Starting as a humble poet, I quickly climbed to the top of my profession, assuming a position of leadership and honour. Is it right that a woman should call me out now? Yes, I am a Kennedy. And I await your orders. You are the new Americans. The homeless are wandering the streets of our nation's greatest city. Homeless men with AIDS are among them. Is that right? That there are no homes for the homeless? That there is no free medical help for these men and women? That they get the message, as they are dying, that this is not their home? And how are your teeth today? Can you afford to fix them? How high is your rent? If art is the highest and most honest form of communication of our times, and the young artist is no longer able to move here to speak to her time. Yes, I could, but that was 15 years ago. And remember, as I must, I am a Kennedy. Shouldn't we all be Kennedys? This nation's greatest city is home of businessmen and home of the rich artist. People with beautiful teeth who are not on the streets. What shall we do about this dilemma? Listen, I've been educated. I've learned about Western civilization. Do you know what the message of Western civilization is? I am alone. Am I alone tonight? I don't think so. Am I the only one with bleeding gums tonight? Am I the only homosexual in this room tonight? Am I the only one whose friends have died or are dying now? And my aunt can't be supported until it is gigantic, bigger than everyone else's, confirming the audience's feelings that they are alone, that they alone are good, deserve to buy the tickets to see this art. Our working, our healthy, should survive and are normal. Are you normal tonight? Everyone here, are we all normal? It is not normal for me to be a Kennedy, but I am no longer ashamed, no longer alone. I'm not alone tonight because we're all Kennedys and I am the president.
By Havasa Grace. You can find it at thenerve.com. I roll in a joint because working at a strip club is more fun when you're high. Little orange hairs fall onto the duvet and I brush them aside. I'll share this with a few of the girls and in return they'll help me make money. The ones who don't get invited will wonder why and start doing me favours. Dressing room politics. The evening light feels heavy. Pale gold liquid from the streetlights outside my window. I finish rolling the joint and pull the covers back over me, pressing myself into Sarah's fat, warm body. Her silky hair covers my eyes and fills my mouth. She moans loosely, and I think about calling in sick again, but the power bill bills due next week, and there's a big rugby game on, which means money. I tiptoe to the bathroom, wrapped in a towel. Cold creeps up from the floorboards, spreading an ache through the soles of my feet. I can see my breath misting out in front of me. and Sarah's soft skin is calling to me from the bedroom. The sun is low and it floods the hallway, but does nothing to warm up the damp walls of the house. In the shower, I cup my heavy breasts and pee against the glass door. Sarah will sleep late and make eggs before she goes. She'll leave her wet towel on the floor of the bathroom and a dirty pan in the sink. I rub my eyes and wonder when I'll work up the strength to tell her to stop coming around. Maybe I'll get hit by a bus on my way to work and I won't have to. The water surrounds me and I think back to Tahiti, where the air felt like swimming through hot, damp sleet. I went to learn French and stayed with a family in Papeete, who had a daughter my age. My body seemed to blossom in the heat, and I would lock myself in the bathroom to masturbate frantically late at night when the family had gone to sleep. My host sister, Leslie, was cruel and childish. She loved to mock my crude accent in front of her friends, and constantly told me my short hair made me look boyish and ugly. I fell hopelessly in love with her, and fought to keep myself from staring at the way her long, dark eyelashes made shadows against her cheeks. "Name regarde pas," she shouted once in frustration at me across the dinner table, making me flinch and drop my fork. One Sunday, we drove to the beach at Venus Point. The day had been dry so far, but the deep turquoise water and black sand stretched out parallel to the grey clouds spreading across the sky, forming a highway of soft monochrome. The air was heavy with the scent of vanilla and impending rain. Leslie's parents had dropped us off at the beach, promising to return in a couple of hours. Leslie and her brother were throwing rocks out into the water, seeing who could throw the farthest. I wandered up the beach and waded out into the waves. The water was warm, and I was up to my waist when the rain started. It began abruptly, filling the air with big, soft drops of warm water. I was enveloped, barely finding space between the raindrops to catch breath. I could faintly hear Leslie calling my name from the shore and looked back to find her hunched with her brother under a mango tree. The torrential rain was knocking all the mangoes off the branches and they were hopping from foot to foot, arms curving defensively above their heads, trying to avoid the falling fruit. They looked like dancers performing some demented ballet on a stage that was falling apart. I laughed and waved away their shouts, turning back to the horizon. It seemed so pointless trying to stay dry. Leslie's voice faded away, and I tipped my head back, letting my mouth fill with rain. I knew I should go back and wait with the others for her parents to return, but the sky and the ocean had merged, and I was overcome with expansive, grey-blue inertia. I could drown, I thought. They might not notice in time, and I would slip quietly away. Back in the bedroom, I dressed quickly, trying not to disturb Sarah. I'll have to do my hair and makeup at work, surrounded by gossip and backhanded compliments, but I don't want to have to say goodbye. The streets are barely warmer than my house. The sun is bright, but the wind is sharp against my cheeks. I curl into myself, trying to wrap my body in thoughts of tropical rain. I can keenly feel the homesickness that had overwhelmed me as a teenager. Back then, the hours had seemed endless, measured in sticky, sweat-drenched passes at the second hand. My dance bag is heavy with rhinestone shoes and tangled hair extensions. I decide to keep the joint for myself and smoke most of it outside. I can hear the music pulsing with wet intensity, and a customer throws me a knowing look, sniffing the air as I walk past him. The other girls chatter in the dressing room, their voices like seagulls screaming over dropped food. I'll skip makeup, I can dance with damp hair. A stained red carpet pushes up against my heels, my vision clouds, lights shimmer. Everything is dark sand and endless warm water. I'm suddenly eager to strip. It seems pointless to try and stay dry.
Manifesto that I wrote with Maya Middleton, and then I'm going to conference call her, and she's going to listen. Part 1, The Trouble with Art. Hashtag win a man. One, Fresh and Fruity doesn't work with domineering personalities. Two, even though Poppy was a gallery director, Art spoke over her and dismissed any problem they had because Poppy was being too sensitive. Three, Crystal realized only recently that Art never respected her ideas or ever listened to anything she said. Hashtag stand and look pretty. Hashtag catwalk on. Four, some of the works they made together made Crystal feel like she was a prop for some kind of sexual voyeurism. She felt her body was being fetishized. Hashtag get Crystal's makeup looks. Five, Crystal felt uncomfortable at the time yet felt powerless to question the true intention of their collaboration. Hashtag bitchlorette. Six, Art laughed and told Danny that women can't be curators and identity politics was only relevant in the 1970s. Hashtag post-feminist utopia. Seven, Crystal was horrified by the naming and shaming of her friend Alicia. Even if it was just online, it was aggressive, hyper-masculine, and unnecessary. Eight, Fresh and Fruity doesn't work with domineering personalities. Nine, no one questioned the fact that Art made tapestries based around porn because he was a hashtag bad boy and part of the hashtag boys club. Art denied any reading of his work that focused upon feminized labor. 10. Art claimed to be psychically connected to his work. It flowed freely from his inner male genius. Art felt he did not need to articulate his conceptual underpinnings because he's an artist. Hashtag seminal flow. 11. Art was a curator at a gallery Crystal used to work at. He thought he was important, A, because he was a serious male curator, and B, because his father was someone Crystal was supposed to care about but didn't. 12. Art stood over Crystal as she tried to serve canapes at an art opening in City Gallery. As he scoffed all of the canapes and physically blocked her from moving, he then laughed at Crystal and told her how to be a waitress. Hashtag quince paste. 13. Art kept repeating how this was friendly advice, despite the fact that the only other time he spoke to her, he started rubbing her shoulder suggestively and told her the only career she would have would be as a gallery administrator, because women aren't really hired to be curators or gallery directors. Hashtag feminized labor. Feminized labor. Hashtag gallery girl. 14. Poppy felt uncomfortable having Art as her supervisor. She felt his gaze on her at all times. No one in the department believed her when she told them Art had sexually assaulted her, even though he had a long history of inappropriate behavior. Hashtag academia is killing my friends. 15. Crystal thought about Deleuze in the shower while listening to Nick Jonas, and then contemplated buying a purity ring. Hashtag imagine success. 16. Art is inherently misogynistic, but this sickness is less visible than others because he bought a Fiona Partington last year. Hashtag ally. 17. This sickness is so widespread he never questions it, but rather fetishizes difference. Art doesn't care, as long as they aren't bad to look at, paleo, and will make him a return. 18. Art would never put Danny out before. Hashtag paleo. Hashtag clean. Hashtag purity. 19. Danielle B had to leave Art because she realized he was dumb as shit. Hashtag winterman. She's not a barista, she's a barrister. Clay's Oldenburg and Hannah Wilkie's relationship. Hashtag fuckboy. Crying for Anna Mendieta, crying for Hannah Wilkie, erase her. 20. Marina and Art moving from one end of the Great Wall of China to the other. Breaking up. Crying. Women's Day. Hashtag Team Danny. 21. Crystal started crying on the internet because the proposal got turned down. Hashtag crying on the internet. She then saw that Art had made a picture of underage teen porn, his exhibition's cover photo. When she brought up the fact that no one had given consent for this image to be used, no one really seemed to care. Hashtag Kiwi bloke aesthetic. Hashtag kill me. Crystal wondered why no one had bothered to question this, except for maybe her. 22. Haraway talks of cyberspace allowing women to be free from their bodies and to become cyborgs. One is never free from the body. Hashtag rape threats online. 23. Art dressed in brownface for a Bollywood-themed party, but thought it was completely fine because the party host was part Indian. Hashtag chocolate-covered treat. 24. When Danielle B asked Art why they only focused upon heteropatriarchal Eurocentric theorists, Art told her both that identity politics was over
and that we now lived in a post-colonial world. When Art said this, he emphasized the post in post-colonial. Art then talked about the reverse racism that he had experienced since one time he went to a marae. Danielle B suddenly realized she was the only Indigenous person in the room. Hashtag Art History. 25. Are you on your period? Art said to Crystal and any other woman who attempts to enforce a boundary or calls Art out for being time-consuming and hard to work with. 26. Art feels an entitlement to all resources and space. This attitude isn't exclusive to age or any particular mode of art making, but is especially prevalent amongst some painters. 27. Art said my work is sexist law, hashtag identity politics. 28. Crystal wondered why Matilda's experiences were of more significance than her own. Crystal hated the way Matilda made her feel like a bad feminist for not using a moon cup. 29. What does it mean to be adequately representational and inclusive? Crystal thought about this every time Art complained that he only managed to sell 3 paintings at a gallery who represented only one woman. 30. Art told me the collaboration I devised lacked substance. 31. Art shaved off all of Danny's hair, and she shaved off his. It felt empowering in a hashtag just girly things kind of way. She thought in establishing a rhizomatic pattern of working, but he just felt entitled to her body. 32. Maybe there aren't like more Māori artists in galleries because they don't apply. Maybe people opt out of applying because they are subtly excluded from white male-dominated spaces law. Hashtag post-racist utopia. Hashtag we gave them a treating. 33. Art couldn't understand why Alicia's parents couldn't afford to help her with living costs while studying, while he lived alone in a huge apartment debt-free. Hashtag Quince Pace. 34. Art tried to tell me that a gallery was inclusive for the mere fact that 2 women ran it. 35. University of Otago officials tried to say there was no rape culture on campus. So many rapists are allowed to be in positions of immense power and influence. Crystal had to leave student radio because she realized they hired more rapists than women. 36. Art made a sculpture of a dolphin because he's interested in the fact that dolphins rape, therefore rape is natural. Hashtag misogyny. Hashtag Rowan Whelans. 37. Even in progressive circles, Art sees himself as an ally, even as being feminist in ideology, and yet he remains uncritical of his behavior and that of his peers. Art is allowed to speak because he's male. Art forgets that judging a woman's body is misogynistic, but they are right to look at. Hashtag all women's bodies are for art. Hashtag white male fantasies. 38. Crystal wrote a review for Art's critical art blog. Art removed 3 paragraphs, all her footnotes, amongst a series of other unnecessary and apparently accidental slights. When Crystal questioned him and asked him politely to change these amendments, he told her to calm down and that she was a good girl. Crystal felt as though she was 12. Hashtag cucumber challenge. 39. Crystal asked Art if his gallery wanted to do a sister show to accompany an all-female exhibition she and Danny had been organizing. He replied saying that he was keen to organize an all-male show with a heart emoji. Danny and Crystal didn't see the value in having a sister show. 40. Crystal got worried about how much Poppy had been drinking at an opening at Fuzzy Vibes. Crystal offered her a water bottle, then Poppy disappeared for a time. She had been unable to communicate and was becoming more stumbly, while a gallery patron glared at her for falling on work by Danielle B. Art appeared and was very touchy-feely with Poppy, who really just needed to get an Uber home. 41. Crystal went in the Uber instead of Danny, who really just wanted to drink wine at Peach Pit. Poppy sat in the middle of the cab with Crystal on one side and Art on the other. Art repeatedly told Crystal about how much he cared about Poppy in a hashtag not all men, hashtag he for she kind of way that was super awkward. Art asserted that she was fun and all right to look at, hashtag Michael Hill jeweler. 42. Art is a critic who tried to tell Crystal to be more brazen in her critique and to get into arguments with weird and deeply sensitive people online, hashtag Dunna Stunner. Forgetting, of course, that Art is an old white guy, so the positionality from which he is allowed to critique is quite different. 43. Crystal's label will never be as important as a small gesture Art makes, even if her Instagram is better. Hashtag Lindau. 44. My friend Matilda carries a pocket knife covered in stickers in her bag to feel safe at night, especially while walking around K Road. Art flashed her his dick last week. 45. Danny gave Art a blowjob and he called her a slut because she told him his painting sucked. All she could remember was feeling degraded because he kept forcing her head into his neatly pruned crotch onto his shriveled and veiny choke of a dick. She cried afterwards, then checked Gmail. Hashtag romance. 46. Christy glared at Crystal. Crystal wondered why Christy felt like shitting on her, because she already had to deal with so much bullshit. 47. Then he asked Crystal, how do we come together? 48. Poppy avoided Crystal because she could not handle the way Crystal critiqued her interest in feminism. Crystal felt it was reductive to focus upon the gendering of space and the division of labor. Hashtag effortless. Hashtag I woke up like this. Hashtag woke bitch. 49. Art made a racial slur on a post on Danny's page. When Crystal pointed this out, Art and Art's friend, Art, made it into a joke because, lol, Crystal is racist against white people. 50. Crystal wondered, what does giving up space look like? What does it mean to listen and to not be competitive in terms of oppression and traumatic lived experience? 51. Art ran a gallery that only really sold work by male artists. He chose to have his meetings in a strip club because lol, he represents one woman, so it's okay. Hashtag cucumber challenge. Hashtag not safe for work. 52. Art cornered Crystal in the middle of a zine fest to yell at her for disassociating with him because he had sexually assaulted her friend. 53. Art then manipulated Crystal's friend into giving him her email so he could send her four diatribe-style emails about how he was a great guy and her friends were liars because he has three sisters. Hashtag not all men. 54. Art wrote on Facebook that Danny was a keyboard warrior after expressing the fact that his radio station wasn't a safe space for women. Art completely devalued her experience of rape at the hands of one of his colleagues. Hashtag Radio One, hashtag allies. 55. Art rehired a man with a long history of rape and sexual assault. Art gave him a show on his radio station without helping him receive any counseling because nine women are just trying to drag down his pro-feminist radio station. Hashtag I don't fuck with Radio One, hashtag boycott. 56. Poppy had a panic attack after looking at a Facebook event page for a feminism event that listed a radio station as feminist, despite the fact that it employed one of the men who had raped her and did not employ any women. 57. The student association did nothing for Crystal when she disclosed to them about one of her friends being raped and repeatedly sexually assaulted by a person employed by them because evidence, despite the fact that other women had made complaints about this man. 58. Matilda told Crystal that she wasn't a real Māori because her feelings of cultural dislocation weren't valid. 59. Whenever Crystal explained that of course she had some benefits in being white passing, but that her connection to her tīpuna had been cut off after years of family tragedy, Matilda laughed at her and told her that she just didn't care about her cultural heritage. 60. Matilda, as a wealthy white woman, asked Crystal what percentage Māori she was and whether she had a scholarship at uni. 61. Matilda still put a picture of Crystal on a wall for her exhibition because even though she was white passing, she was a woman of colour and she only had one other woman of colour. 62. Whenever Danielle B tried to discuss her mental health issues, Matilda explained that hers were worse. When Danielle B tried to kill herself, Matilda told everyone she just wanted attention. 63. When Alicia explained to Art that she couldn't afford to see a shrink, Art laughed and told her, maybe it's just in your head, babe. 64. Art made sure that everyone knew that he was a feminist, despite the fact that he refused to support Natalie after their flatmate tried to rape her. Her other friend Matilda told her not to make a fuss. 65. Art was such a great feminist that when he spoke over the top of Crystal talking about her experience of racism within university, it was because she just didn't get it, because the white male lecturer related to men better. 66. Christy tried to pretend that it didn't hurt when Art waved his hand in her face to prevent her from speaking at work. She tried to pretend that it wasn't because she was not only the only woman, but the only brown person in the company. 67. Art told Crystal that Woody Allen was a genius, but Chris Brown was a thug. Hashtag racist. Just conference call.
One. Automatic hashtag allies because they work in the hashtag feminine. post-feminist and utopian society. She knows the pressures of patriarchal paradigms. Hashtag ask for the people. Hashtag live, love, love.